top.
Thank you. Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Tuesday, March 25th, 2003, and we are continuing today the public hearing on House Bill 5016, the Department of Education, as it relates to the State School Fund. Please have the record reflect that Representative Smith is excused today on personal business, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 5016. I have been informed by Legislative Fiscal that the Department of Education is working on the answers to the questions that we asked in yesterday's hearing, but they haven't gotten anything definitive yet to give us, and so that will be coming our way. Ms. McGlashan, you have a couple of pieces of information that you wanted to set before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, we talked yesterday about some per-student calculations, and I mentioned some calculations that are done by our Legislative Revenue Office, and so I provided for you two single pieces of paper that have some of those calculations on them, and I just wanted to briefly go over them. You'll see the first one, which at the bottom is labeled F7, just kind of shows you on an actual per student funding basis the trend line in funding over the last 10 years or so. And you can see if you compare that to the charts that you saw yesterday, the trend line is pretty similar. I would point out that the one from LRO does not incorporate the governor's budget, so you need to stop at the 02-03 year in the charts from yesterday when you're trying to compare the two sources. And then the second page is F8, and These calculations are using a U.S. CPI, and I just wanted to bring your attention to the bottom two squares, one using ADM R adjusted for inflation and the other one using ADM W adjusted for inflation. And if you look at the square on the bottom left for 92-93, it shows a $6,568 amount per student. And if you were to refer back to the Department of Education's charts, their amount for that year is $6,676. And their amount for 2002-03 is $6,126, a difference of about $550 per student. The two bars that you see on the LRO graph, the difference is about $500 per student. So you can see, regardless of what CPI factor you use, you're going to get roughly the same kind of outcome in terms of the overall difference. And the same is true for the bottom square, or the on the right, that square on the bottom. The difference between the department's figures from 92-93 to 2002-03 is about $750, and the difference between the LRO figures is about $735. So again, comparable difference when you're looking over the 10-year period. So I just wanted to provide those to you because we talked about those yesterday.
Well, and I do think, committee members, that this is a great way to point out how it's very difficult to arrive at one set of numbers that everyone is going to agree is the exact perfect picture of what's going on, but that we need to make an effort to lay information out before the committee that shows kind of the field that we're working in, but bearing in mind that this is by far an inexact kind of a science here. Now, we also received a copy of this document.
Correct. Madam Chair, the and members, the Department of Education has provided to you the 2001-02 Oregon report card, and this is an annual report that the department provides to the legislature on public schools. It's got a lot of good data in it about benchmarks, the quality ed model, student enrollment, and so forth. And so they wanted to provide that to you for your reading and enjoyment.
The one more announcement before we open or get actually into the public hearing part of this. Ms. Ames from DAS and BAM is on the agenda for today, but I've made the decision to pull her off the agenda today and put her on the agenda tomorrow at the point at which we will have received the department's presentation, the result, and the results of the three audits, and then use that as kind of a baseline or a kind of, I guess, the ribbon on the package here. And we'll proceed in that way. So I'm going to skip over that piece of the agenda. I didn't want anybody to be surprised by that. And with that, I think the best thing to do here is just to continue with the department's report. And so I'll turn this over to Mr. Burke and Mr. Reeder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back before you this morning. I'd like to, just before moving forward, just clarify one thing that happened right at the end of yesterday's meeting and the information about special education funding. The $204 million shortfall, Representative March, I'm sure you know, I just wanted to clarify, we don't have a choice about those expenditures. They are required by law. So that $204 million shortfall is something that we have to do anyway, even though it was not fully funded by the federal government at the 40% level. I'm sure you understand. I just wanted to clarify that. That is in our budget, and it is a required expenditure.
So you spend the 200, pardon me, Madam Chair, you spend the what is required by the law, i.e., you spend that 204, even though the feds haven't reimbursed you for what was in at one time promised.
Madam Chair, Representative March, that is absolutely correct. And part of our current effort in Washington, D.C., with the reauthorization of IDEA, is to see if we can move the figure, what is currently about 14%, closer to the 40% original figure that was in the federal law. But the law requires us to provide the services to students regardless of the funding source. So we have to spend the money.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to be following up with my representative in Congress and senators, and I urge all the members to do so.
Mr. Burt, do the other states have similar problems to Oregon in the gap of what we get from the federal government to fund special ed and what the states actually put into it? Where is Oregon in the national picture with reference to that issue?
Madam Chair, we are in exactly the same boat with every state in the United States. Our overall student population receiving special education services is right at about the national average. We are our services in terms of funding are capped at 11% of population. The number of students that we serve is slightly higher than that, closer to about 12%, and that's right at about the national average. 12 to 15% is the national average. But every state is in exactly the same boat as Representative March described yesterday, and that is the federal law originally passed set a target for federal funding at 40% of cost for students receiving special education services. However, the federal allocation nationwide has only been at about 14%, so there is a very significant funding gap between the original federal goal and what was actually provided. The problem with these costs is that the law is very clear that the provision of service is distinct from funding stream. So local states have no choice. These are students who have a legal right to the services that are provided. So the state must make up the difference. And we are in exactly the same boat as everyone else.
Can you talk to the committee about the regulations that are around the required level of service? Do we have any discretion in what that level of service is? I mean, how is it arrived at?
Madam Chair, the level of service is strictly controlled in law. This is driven by a process called the Individual Education Plan. And this is a process that involves the local school, the local school district staff in terms of diagnosis of the need for service, and then a mutual planning process that involves the parent, professional staff, and the local school in developing what's called an individual education plan, or an IEP. And the level of service is strictly controlled by that IEP. And staff, in consultation with parents and professionals, diagnose the need of the child and then provide the best service available. The law requires that service be provided in what's known as the least restrictive environment, meaning that we must try to provide the service in as natural a setting as possible. Senator Messerly yesterday mentioned mainstreaming and what's the overall cost of mainstreaming students. Mainstreaming is a concept that refers to putting kids in the least restrictive environment or the most natural setting as possible. And all of that is controlled by the individual education plan. The parent approves it, the district provides the service, and then there is an annual evaluation of the impact of those services with the parent.
So what I hear you say then is that the cost is not one of the considerations in this discussion at all?
I would say in the provision of services, districts do try to keep their costs down as much as possible. Now, some costs are in some ways outside of the control of the district. Let me be specific. One child might have a speech and language disorder. That's a relatively mild problem, and it is usually addressed with an itinerant teacher that goes from school to school and serves many children. The other extreme would be a child who is wheelchair-bound, is perhaps nonverbal, has serious acute medical difficulties that require a full-time teacher, a full-time paraprofessional, and a full-time nurse at all times. So we have those extremes. And, for example, the high-risk children with medical conditions, we have very little control over what kinds of services are provided. If that child needs a nurse because they are medically fragile, we will provide that service, or local districts provide that service. Now, there are areas, though, where school districts, in the course of developing the individual education plan, will try to provide service at the local district level as much as possible, as opposed to services in another city in some cases. Those are ways that districts try to keep their costs down. And it's the frequent question is service at every individual neighborhood school versus consolidation of services and moving students to centers in school districts. So there are strategies to try to keep those costs as low as possible.
So in the construction of the IEP, if you have a child that does require a high level of care and the expense is very high for the district, and the child would receive the same level of care and a very viable educational opportunity if they were placed in another program, how does that decision take place? What I'm trying to get at here is how do the parents become involved at this point, and what weight is put on the three legs of the decision-making process that you described to us?
Madam Chair, it's an excellent question. Parents are involved at every step of the way, and the law requires that they approve the placement decisions and recommendations of the IEP team. No child is placed in any program without the approval of the parent. I believe, is more motivated by what is the best service for their child rather than saving the school district money, to be honest. So there is conversation between the school district and the parent about what's the best service that can be provided, and the school district will try to provide that service locally as much as possible, as opposed to a placement elsewhere, which is much more expensive. For example, a residential program out of state, which there are very few students, but there are some. Those are very expensive programs, and the school district will try to provide service to the local district if at all possible. One of the impacts, however, on some districts rather than others, say here in Salem, in the Eugene area, in the Portland metro area, any place where you have significant medical facilities, there is a tendency sometimes for very high-need, high-risk children for their families to locate close to those facilities. And when you locate to those facilities, the education costs, not the medical costs, but the education costs for serving those children academically fall to that local school district. So some school districts have a disproportionate high-need child than other school districts.
I don't think I effectively communicated my question. What I was after was, I think, do the parents have the ability to override the district's sense of what is the best for the child?
I see. I may have misunderstood your question. The answer basically is yes, and ultimately this can end up in court. The parent can refuse service or can challenge either the diagnosis or the placement decision of the local district recommendation. And if they don't agree, the parent can refuse service, and there is an appeal process. And ultimately, through the appeal process, if the local school board continues to deny the request, the parent can appeal to the courts. So ultimately, the answer to your question is yes, the parent can refuse the service and can appeal it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Mesley.
I want to get clarification for myself here. I'm trying to think how to phrase the question, but I've been told anecdotally that some districts can, with their special education programs, can actually have overall financial gains by having special ed students. Now, having said that, I can understand if you've got one of the cases that you mentioned where you're paying for students to go out of state and all this, that obviously that's going to be very, very expensive. But is it true that some districts can literally have financial gain from their special ed students because they are paid at a different level? And I understand that. But this is something I have not heard much conversation about, but I've had this come to me two or three times that a district is actually making money
right.
for their special ed program.
Madam Chair, Senator Meserle, this is an excellent question, and we know that there are questions not only in special ed but also about limited English proficient ESL types of programs, and we are in the process of looking into that more precisely so that we would be able to give you more concrete figures. The problem is difficult at times to analyze. The current funding formula is exactly that. It is a funding formula, and it's based on an assumption, and that is that districts that have larger numbers of students with certain needs have higher costs than districts that have fewer numbers of those students. So the formula is driven to provide additional resources to the school district. It is not a spending plan. So you have these differences in student need that a school district for one student may have very low cost in terms of delivering the service that's required, but for another student, the cost can be very high. So it partially depends on the numbers of students identified, and it partially depends on the type of service required. So the funding formula treats in the example that I use, the low-cost speech and language child and the high-risk medically fragile child are both treated as a double weight in the funding formula. So the service to the child in one case is less expensive than the service to another. Now, I believe that most districts are spending all of their funding in the formula on the services provided for those children, but services have some costs. Let me be specific. Cost to the child to be transported under special circumstances. For example, some special education children require specialized types of transportation vehicles. Those costs are borne by the district and would appear in their transportation costs. So the funding formula is designed to provide the adequate funding at a level that is necessary for the district to meet all of its obligations, including transportation, food services, their business expenses, and so on. So. We know that this is an area that you want to look into. We can get you additional information on the breakout of the expenditure versus the amount of money received in the weight.
I'm sure can I have a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Is the department interested, or are you moving in the direction of taking a look at that formula and maybe tying it, having different categories of special education and tying it closer to the needs of the students?
We would be interested, Madam Chair, Senator Mesler, we'd be interested in having that conversation. We have not taken a position on that as yet. It's a complicated area because, as I mentioned, it's hard to break out all of the costs associated with special education. There are the direct costs of providing the program, but there are peripheral costs that also would need to be clearly identified. But we'd be happy to have that conversation.
Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several questions along these lines.
Please proceed.
Your department has an opportunity to see in a sort of a global way how special ed kids function inside our systems and the support that the school systems give more than individual districts can sometimes, which is difficult for districts to see sometimes. And so you have a unique opportunity. Are you seeing an increase in the percentage of kids being tagged as special ed kids because of changing efforts to get diagnosis, to be more aggressive in diagnosis? Or do you think there's really a real absolute increase in the number of these kids in our society? Do you have any feelings about that?
I do have some, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I do have some feelings about it, but this is also an area that would require, again, some more detailed investigation. What we're seeing, as Mr. Reeder indicated yesterday, some of the increase is in areas that seem to be fairly specialized, such as autism. And one of the factors that drives this is the increased knowledge that we have about this condition and the improved professional development that we provide our staff. In other words, what to look for. And we had a similar situation several years ago regarding students with attention deficit disorder. In the past, many of those children were simply treated as discipline problems, and part of that reflected the fact that we did not understand the condition. We are going through a similar issue, not only here in Oregon, but nationwide, in the area of autism. This is an area where both the medical and psychological information has expanded greatly, and as that then filters into how we work with families and children, things in the past that we may have simply treated as a discipline problem or that's just a difficult child, we now understand can have its cause in a disorder that can be effectively treated. So as that continues, we then process identify more children who need the service. In addition, in response to Senator Messerly, parents are learning more, and they are putting more demands on the system as they come in and they say, my child, according to my physician, has this condition, and I would like to talk with you about what services can be provided. The real problem here, I believe, is the conversation that we had with Representative March. The problem is that we are getting better at identifying children who have special needs, and there is this gap between the number of children that we identify and the funding that we had been told would be available from the federal government. But as we identify the children, we still have to provide the service.
Madam Chair.
Uh-huh.
Oh, thank you. One of the services you potentially could offer to districts is helping them with Medicaid funding for some of these children.
That's correct.
I know there's been some real frustration in some districts in that they were billing for transportation costs for these special ed children, many of whom were qualified for Medicaid. The federal government came back and started auditing these programs and felt the documentation was inappropriate and demanded the money back with penalties. And I know there was some frustration from the districts when they turned to organizations which they thought would help them, including your department, and felt that they didn't get any support and weren't given direction on how they could have billed more appropriately, or how they could have documented more appropriately, and felt that at times they were just sort of left out there to hang out to dry. There were several districts involved in that in which significant amounts of money were involved. The federal government demanded the money back and demand it with penalty. The worst part is the federal government seemed to understand that, in fact, that the work done was legitimate. Moving these kids to a place where they got special services was appropriate, but still wanted the money back. Are you aware of that problem, and would you comment on it?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I am aware of the problem. This occurred prior to my coming to the agency, so I am probably not the best person to talk about the history of this. We are investigating what we can do with Medicaid reimbursement to improve the service. I would say that we acted in good faith and tried to find a way to utilize this opportunity to offset some of our costs. But you are correct. Some of those costs have been challenged, Representative Bates. And we're looking into how we can improve the information to school districts on how to appropriately identify and account for those costs. I don't believe that school districts intentionally or fraudulently or in any way tried to misrepresent those costs. But you are correct that some of our documentation was not adequate, and we are moving to fix that issue. I would suggest, if you really want to go into that in depth, to that we could work through our special education department to get you a detailed analysis of this problem.
Madam Chair, I'd appreciate that.
If I could interject, too, I think that one of the strategies that we are being very aggressive about as we try to deal with the revenue situation that the state finds itself in is trying to maximize the federal match that we can get. And certainly this is one area that I think would be very worthy of exploration. And I would be very interested in getting documentation on the work plan that you have in place and the timelines that you have in place to deal with this issue.
Madam Chair, we will certainly do that, and we certainly share your concern. We want to do this right. It is a potentially good funding source for us. We did not like having our documentation challenged. We don't want to see that happen again, and we would be happy to bring you information about it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you have any further questions?
You actually covered my next one. Thank you.
Oh.
One of the things that you might, I'm going to take a tact here with you, which I hope you'll take the right way. Your department is often seen by districts as not being as helpful as it could be. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes just seen as something that you have to push paperwork for, and they come once a year and they go away. But you really do have a role to play here, an important role for other districts. And this is one of those roles. If you could lead in this and show districts how to appropriately approach the federal government for proper match money, it would be a real boon to those districts and help them out financially and help those kids out more. So I would encourage you to please be a leader in this. Make sure we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's and making the feds happy. Because
right.
I agree with you, this was not a fraudulent attempt by school districts. This was a bureaucratic maze you couldn't get out of. And then the districts find themselves up against 12 attorneys from Portland who are all on the federal payroll, and all they want to do is notch a few guns in their pistol, and these districts are getting fried out there, and right. No one's helping them. And the publicity from it is also difficult for them when they did nothing wrong. So I'd appreciate you helping them out in that way. Last question, Madam Chair.
Well, and if I might just interject a point along that line, too, that having spent a number of hours down in the audit committee taking a look at these issues and kind of getting a very small measure of the dimensionality of the issue, it would seem too that there would be the potential for an alliance here with the DHS folks who are very scoped in on how to accomplish these kinds of processes in the Medicaid connection to try to work with the local districts to make this work.
Madam Chair, thank you for the suggestion and to Representative Bates as well. Prior to coming to the agency, I was involved in a local district sort of at the other end of this process. So I've been at both ends of the process, and you are absolutely correct. The connection with human services is a very important component of this. Actually, there are a number of areas where working collaboratively benefits both agencies and helps reduce the cost as well. I would say that we thought we were on track on this issue. We obviously disagreed with the audit. We felt we were doing it properly. We will correct any errors that occurred and get this back on track, because this is an important collaboration and a funding stream.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last note being, many districts now said they're just not going to do it again. They don't feel the risk is worthwhile. It's too much trouble. And so the federal government will walk away from this program once again on us. And so I'm sure you're aware of that, and we'll take steps. Last question is a broad one again. many of us, this is going to be a politically incorrect question, and you can walk away from this question if you want to, like the Fed walks away from everything else. Many of us are concerned that the special ed children are not always receiving the services they really need in the setting they really need, not because of the district's position, but sometimes because of the parents' position. And we're also concerned about the effect on the rest of the classroom, the rest of the kids in the school, in some of those situations. This is a system that that commonly ends up in court or threats of court. And I'd like to have your comments statewide of how you feel this program is rolling out as far as those issues are concerned. And you can walk away from this one if you want to.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I tend not to want to walk away from hard questions. I think it's an excellent question. You are correct, is my best answer, that there are occasions where school districts and parents disagree. And sometimes the parent thinks the child needs more service than what the district may think is necessary, that they can meet the conditions identified, and that's a way of controlling their costs. And the opposite sometimes is also true, that the school district thinks that the child needs additional service that the parent refuses. And in both instances, you're correct. There is a concern. Are we doing the absolute best that we can for the child? In the example that you identified, the district can continue to, if the parent has refused placement for the services that the district feels is necessary, and the parent can refuse that, but that doesn't mean at that point that the district is now totally free to disregard any of the evidence that they see in the classroom. That plan needs to be evaluated on a regular basis, at least annually, but at any time, both the parent and the school district can independently ask for what's called an IEP review, which is a formal meeting to come in and say, we have a plan, but it's not working. Here's some data that we have. We need to review the appropriateness of the plan. And either the school district or the parent can ask for that. And you're correct that sometimes the school district will place a child and then evaluate the progress of the child, and if they believe that the placement is inaccurate, and as the student is, as in your example, disrupting the learning environment for other children for whatever reason, the district can request that that be reviewed. In the same manner that parents can legally challenge an IEP placement, the school district also can move if they feel that the parent action is putting the child at risk or is totally inappropriate. The district can legally challenge that decision on the part of the parent as well. In either case, going to court over these issues is not something that we would welcome. We would try to continue to negotiate with the family and try to use data as much as possible. The overall objective here is that students make progress and that they show both academic, social, and emotional gains. And if that's not occurring, then the teachers and principal of that school and their IEP review team would meet with the parents to see if an adjustment in the IEP is necessary. These are very difficult decisions. Your question is an excellent one. And this is an area where special education staff continue to try to upgrade their skills. We try to provide the best diagnostic skills that we can. And then the real key here, in my opinion, is the local school creating a positive climate for parents to see the school and the parents as partners in trying to find the best solution to the problem that the child has. We are not advocates and are adversaries in these decisions. We should be partners in these decisions. And that, to me, is the ultimate answer.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the constraints of the system monetarily, where we're not covering the full costs of special education, isn't it more often the case that the districts or schools are put in the place of suggesting fewer services than parents are seeking?
Madam Chair, Representative March, I cannot give you an exact figure on that, so my response is more anecdotal, which always makes me nervous. I'd like to research that a little bit more and get some hard numbers for you. But yes, the answer would basically be yes. And one of the measures of this is that you can identify the legal costs to school districts in special education. And part of that reflects going to court over the decisions about placement and services. And there are cases where, as I mentioned earlier, the parent would like a far more expensive service or a very specialized service. The school district may feel that it has services that fully meet the conditions identified in the IEP, and it would rather use the less expensive service in order to manage its cost. Remember that special education costs in the formula are capped at 11% of population, but services are not capped. However many students you identify, they're legally entitled to receive the service. So the school district is trying to manage its budget and meet the needs of the child.
Well, actually, just a comment. I mean, I think that one of the problems then is this creates an adversarial system where we're wasting money on legal issues, on legal cases, where the way the parent can handle the IEP process is to say, no, I deny your plan, and so the child is the one who's losing. The child is not getting services, and it's not just even in big districts like Portland. It's also, I know, like Gaston had a problem. You get a family who moves in with a number of special needs children, and all of a sudden, your costs leap, far beyond what we're reimbursing. And it's a problem where we need to get the federal government to live up to their promise, as well as, try to take that adversarial part out of the system. Because the welfare of the child is what's being lost here.
A process question that is interesting to me: if you have the negotiation going on the form of the IEP, and there is not an agreement that's reached between the providers and the parents, what happens to the child? Are they denied service until that agreement's reached?
It depends if it's initial service or continuing service. If it's part of an IEP review, the service already being received by the child would be continued until the new IEP is agreed upon. If it's initial service, we are legally restricted to provide those services unless the parent has agreed. So in that case, if it's a brand new student, we would not be providing service until the parent has agreed to it. So the child would be in a regular classroom until the IEP is in place.
And in the case of a child who transferred from one district to another, does the IEP follow the child, or does that cause a new one to be negotiated?
Madam Chair, it's an excellent question. By federal law, that IEP is in effect wherever the child is. The IEP is not tied to a local school district. So the child has been identified in one district, moves to another, the IEP is automatically in effect, and at the time of registration, either the parent identifies the child, or as records are exchanged, the child is identified as being in special education. At that point, there would be an additional IEP review meeting in the new district to talk not about reauthorization, but to talk about how the services in the existing IEP would be met in the new district. It's automatically in effect.
But in that case, the child would be receiving services under the existing IEP while the negotiations were taking place.
Absolutely. The child is always entitled to receive the service once they have been identified. That, by the way, I would also just remind the committee, is also true of Oregon charter schools, that if the student goes to an approved charter school, the school district does not in any way relinquish its legal obligation to meet the special education needs of the child, even if they are in a charter school.
Thank you. Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you. I think you say that the 11% cap, could you expand on that, how that works? I think I'd be interested in a breakout of districts that have both more than 11% of their population in special ed, and just how that plays out across the state. it sounds to me like there's definitely winners and losers in this process. School districts.
Losers and bigger losers, probably.
Madam Chair, Senator Meserle, we'd be happy to get that information for you. I don't have it with me, but we do have that information. Again, the issue is always driven by what are the needs of the child. And so the district is not in any way, or should not in any way, be saying that I either have to identify 11% or that I can only identify 11% or that I should under-identify 11%. The issue should be, what are the needs of this child? Now, you are correct that some districts identify more than 11% and some less. What happens in that case is that if districts have identified fewer than 11%, but the overall budget included that amount of money, then there is additional unallocated revenue, usually a small amount. Districts that have exceeded the 11% can submit a supplemental request based upon the needs that they have, and those funds are reallocated. The remaining funds are reallocated based on a review of the request from the school districts. In my experience, in the past, that has never approached a full funding for where districts are. It's something much less, and we try to distribute the funds as equitably as we can among the districts that were over the 11% cap. I believe the figure last year, as I recall, I wasn't with the agency then, was somewhere around 11.8%, closer to 12% as the total number of students identified. So that difference between 11% and the total population was not fully funded, but a partial funding was achieved based on districts that had identified fewer than 11% and the savings there.
I'm sure I could have a follow-up. I'm interested in how the figure of 11% was arrived at, and is that in statutes? Is that in administrative rule? And as we've identified, we have the ability of identifying special ed students better now and probably have an increasing percentage of them, number of them. So is that 11% variable? Exactly how does that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Meserle, I'm not the best person to answer that question. We can get you additional information on that. I'll share with you my knowledge, limited as it may be. The 11% is variable. It was set in the formula based on an average, particularly of Western states at the time when the formula was created. I would say that Oregon is not alone. I know for sure that we are not alone in states in the United States that are seeing increases in the number of students identified. I want to make a parenthetical statement. I think we are also getting better at identifying children earlier and intervening earlier to remediate these conditions and to reduce the long-term impact on the school districts. For example, we have a birth to five program. We are not alone. Most states have a birth to five program. So we are, in fact, identifying children with learning disabilities prior to their birth. And we know that some children, because of prenatal conditions, are going to be born with serious handicapping conditions. And our early intervention program is identifying students from that point on so that even before they ever hit the funding formula at kindergarten or grade at age five, we are already providing services to those children. So as we get better at identifying that, we have more children entering the system earlier, already identified for special education, and that drives up the number. So I believe you're correct. The 11% may not be a correct or accurate figure at this point. But at the time when it was established, it was an average, particularly in the Western states, and Oregon's history, about how many students overall are identified as having handicapping conditions. A double weight in the formula is also a variable figure. It was put in as an average at the time that the funding formula was created. That that's in the definition of the funding formula now, but that funding formula can be changed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning.
Good morning.
Would like to explore a couple of areas with you. First of all, what is your assessment of why we have a disproportionate number of students of color identified for special education?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, it's a very, very difficult question to answer. There are, I believe, a couple of issues. One is the impact of poverty, the impact of some students growing up in an environment that may have limited their cognitive development when they enter school. I believe that the issue is not as much about color as it is about the impact of poverty and some students not having the linguistic development and background, cognitive development and background entering school with some identified learning disabilities. As you know, we have been struggling over time even with the impact of chronic alcohol abuse or drug abuse either during pregnancy or after birth in the environment. We also know that there is a significant impact even now. A lot of people think that this has gone away, but there is significant impact even of lead-based paint in some parts of the city or of our communities. So there are a variety of issues that may be related to poverty. I do believe, however, Senator Gordley, and this is what I was just saying to Senator Messersohn, I think we are also faced with the fact that some of our instructional programs may not be adequate to meet the needs of the children when they enter school. Let me be specific. What we're seeing, particularly in response to the National Reading Panel work, as you may know, Oregon has a Reading First grant, and we are working with 35 schools around early childhood reading instruction. One of the things that we are excited about in that program is that there is some evidence that taking these instructional strategies early in pre-kindergarten through third grade, that we can overcome some reading disabilities without having to refer the child to special ed. So part of my answer, Senator Gordley, is that we may not be using the most effective instructional strategy. So when students not making progress, I believe teachers like to feel that they are being successful. And if they are not being successful in the classroom, there is a tendency to say, I need additional help. They don't necessarily say, I think this child is handicapped. They say, I think I need additional help with this child. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, that additional help tends to be either special education or federally funded programs such as Title I. So the degree to which there would be a disproportionate referral because of wanting to be successful with the child may end up with disproportionate representation. I am excited, I must say, I'm very excited about the potential of finding better ways in early childhood to meet the needs of children and get them on track academically without having to refer them to special education. And there's some evidence that that can occur using these new strategies.
An additional question, Madam Chair. Thank you. It would be helpful, Mr. Burt, to see a report, or please tell me if there is an existing report that shows the suspension expulsion rate by district. And then within that data, if it already exists or if it can be compiled, can you show the suspension expulsion rate for special ed students and disaggregate that by race and ethnicity?
Senator
that such a document already exist, or would you have to create that?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we do report on the Oregon report cards. You know, the legislature created not the document that you have, but for each school in each district in the state, there is an annual report card that by law must be published by the 31st of January. So we just published version 4. And that report card does include information on every school on expulsions due to weapons. And it's a requirement not only in, locally but in federal law to identify weapons violations as an indication of whether or not the school is a safe school. To get those data, we do collect information on suspension and expulsion rates. In my best information, Senator Gordley, and I will have to verify this, I am not sure if we can disaggregate that information by special education category. Part of what we are trying to do, as I've mentioned to several committees before, the creation of this mathematical concept of the Secured Student Identification System, or SSID, where each child in the system would eventually have a number that we can use to track and flag all of these services, is being created. It is not fully in place yet. So I don't want to say for sure that I could give you that information disaggregated by special education category. If it exists, I will certainly get it for you. I'm interested in it as well. I'm just not sure that the system can produce it yet. But we can produce overall suspension and expulsion information. We'd be happy to make that available for you.
Thank you. And I appreciate, Madam Chair, that Dr. Burke is also interested in capturing this kind of information. It's an additional diagnostic tool, if you will. Just some other comments on the other topic of developing IEPs and parental involvement. In my other life, I worked with the Oregon Parent Information and Resource Center, which is funded through the federal government with funds that go directly to the Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory and Albina Head Start, and have done a lot of work with parents around the development of IEPs. The last one I was involved in, interestingly, the parents objected to the child was determined to be in need of a psychological assessment, and the parents objected to the psychologist who was assigned to that role. They wanted someone independent and someone who was, in their view, culturally competent. And through some negotiation with the school, we were able to get to that satisfactory result for the parents. So that's far short of having to do litigation. So it is possible to work these things out on the ground with the school staff.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley is widely recognized for her advocacy on the part of children and has just given an excellent example. I would like to I believe, two issues that we're talking about today. One is money, and the other is policy and procedure and advocacy for children. And I believe what Senator Gordley has just given is an excellent example where the two come together. It is a question, I believe, of creating an appropriate environment in which the parent and the school district feel that they are mutually focused on what's best for the child, with the school district and the parent working together for the best solution, using advocates as necessary to do it, and if at all possible, keeping this out of the courts. My experience is that once it gets to court, unfortunately, the need of the child sometimes gets lost in the legal shuffle, and I agree very strongly with what Senator Gordley just said. Doing this without legal intervention and focused on what can we do collectively to help the child is certainly the best strategy. And in the long run, is also the most cost-effective for the local school district as well.
Just a sidebar, and I'll be quiet. The funding that we received through the federal government was for a rural-urban partnership, And we learned in, I think it was November, that we would no longer be receiving that funding. So there are efforts in our rural and urban communities to kind of keep the work going, because we did identify a number of volunteers who committed themselves to carrying forward the work. And we were excited about developing a partnership with our own school district in Portland. So there's good work going on out there.
There's excellent work
in kids and parents.
It's an area that I'm personally interested in expanding. I can say with great certainty, because I've talked with her repeatedly, that our new state superintendent is very committed to establishing partnerships, effective partnerships with community-based organizations, and this is an area that we expect to improve over the coming year.
Colleagues, let me jump in here and exercise some prerogatives as chair. We've scheduled Mr. Warner from the Legislative Revenue Office to come in and talk to us about the Revenue Options School Funding and Accountability Task Force report, which I think the committee is going to find very interesting. We've just had, I think, a very illuminating discussion on the issues around special education. But we have totally derailed the department from finishing their budget presentation. So what I'd like to do is to take the next 15 minutes and finish this presentation, and I would ask my colleagues to hold questions unless you have an extremely burning desire to ask a question, so that we can get Mr. Warner in here. And with that, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can finish my part in three sentences and be done. I refer you to page 17 of the material that we were looking at yesterday. It is titled A Decade of Progress. And I will simply say, and would be happy to come back at any time and give you much more detail, this is clearly a good news, bad news type of situation. The good news is that academic achievement is up. We are performing at some of the highest levels in our history. On not only Oregon State assessments, but on measures such as the National Assessment of Educational Progress. We exceeded both the Western State average and the national average, and on traditional measures such as the SAT and ACT tests, Oregon students are achieving at the highest levels in the country, at literally the highest scores in the United States. If you were to look at page 3 on the Oregon report card booklet that I gave you, you would find that there, what we also have is a continuing achievement gap where students in the state are making progress throughout the time they are in school, but you also notice that the achievement gap continues to exist. And you have heard our state superintendent indicate that this is one of her top three priorities to address and to take specific steps to close the achievement gap. I was going to talk a little bit about that, but in the interest of time, let us move on. The dropout rate is also at the lowest level that it has been in 10 years, 4.9%. We're very proud of that. It means that programs in our schools are being very effective at reducing the dropout rate. On the other hand, we know that this is not a time to accept that as an acceptable level. It continues to be high, or higher among low-income and minority students, so we have additional work to do there. And finally, we know that there is paperwork in the system that needs to be analyzed and addressed. We are looking at a variety of demands on teacher time and to see if there are ways that we can reduce that and free up more time for instruction. So that's my brief version, Madam Chair, and I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Reeder.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the subcommittee. If we start on page...
Mr. Reeder, for the record, could you identify yourself today?
Yeah, Brian Reeder, Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you.
Starting on page 21, I think what I'd like to do here is... give the subcommittee sort of the context in which the 0305 budget will be set for education, and to do that, briefly look at where we are in 0103 and how we managed to get to where we are. Slide 21 takes a look at the cuts that have been made so far during this biennium, using the end of session appropriation for the state school fund as a starting point. What this shows is that through the fifth special session, the legislature cut $149.7 million. There were further reductions in December that resulted from a revised state revenue forecast, cuts that the governor made totaling $46.2 million. The failure of Measure 28 in January required another cut of $95 million. And we also are looking at an estimated cut of $8.3 million additional dollars due to shortfall in the Medicaid upper limit payment amounts that Oregon receives from the federal government. The total there is $299 million. You'll note down in the footnote that it says that does not include $211 million in the accrual adjustment. What that note means is that we did not count that 211 as a cut in these numbers. We assumed that 211, which is really revenue that districts will receive in the 03-04 school year, can be counted as a resource for 02-03. They can accrue that back if they choose to, keeping in mind that ability to accrue does not create any new resources. It simply provides a tool to districts to manage their cash flow, to use some of that money they will receive next year to offset expenses that they incur this year. Slide 22 expresses where we are today in the 02-03 school year on a per weighted student basis relative to what we were expecting at the close of session. Initial expectations, $5,502. Currently, our best estimate for 02-03 is $4,988 per weighted student. That's a cut of 9.3%. If you take into account the accrual provisions, count those as a cut in 02-03 rather than as a shift, the reduction for the per student available through the formula in 02-03 would be $4,679 rather than $4,988. That's what we will actually be paying districts in 02-03. That represents a cut of 15% relative to what we were expecting at the end of the 01 session. The slide on page 23 starts to get into what we're looking at for the 03-05 biennium. That first column labeled without cuts of $6.01 billion, that is an amount that would be required in 03-05 to provide the same level of services that we thought we would be able to provide at the close of session in 01-03. In other words, had we not had to take these dramatic cuts in the current biennium and had rolled up what we expected to have to 03-05, that amount would be roughly $6 billion. Add to that local revenues of a little bit over $2 billion, and the total state school fund amount, or the amount that is distributed through the formula, would be just shy of $8.3 billion. In contrast to that, the second column shows the governor's balanced budget proposal, $5.05 billion, which is $960 million below what would be required to maintain the 0103 level of services prior to the cuts we've experienced so far. That's a 16% cut in state resources to schools from the current biennium to the next. And since local revenues really have not fallen significantly over this period, It represents a 12% cut in state plus local resources, still a significant cut.
Madam Chair.
Ms. McClash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. I just wanted to provide some additional information on that one slide pertaining to the 960, kind of give you some detail behind that. Certain cuts, most of the cuts taken in 0103 were considered permanent, and the roll-up effect of those cuts into the 0305 biennium is about $500 million. And then about $550, $560 million of this cut is due to the governor's assumption that there will not be any inflation or salary adjustments.
And I believe there is a slide that details the assumptions that's coming
up. That's correct. And then that's $1.06 billion, but then you'll recall that the governor added back $100 million to the budget. So just to give you some more detail behind that information, that figure there.
Thank you. Mr. Reeder.
Thank you. Slide 24 expresses the expected level of revenue under the governor's budget in 0405, and in this case we do it on a single year basis rather than a biennial basis. Compares it to the level of funding back in 1991 to get a longer term perspective on what the current proposed budget really means. Express it on a per weighted student basis and then adjust it for inflation. Per student amount falls from $5,874 to $4,854, a cut of 17.4%. So that really puts in perspective what the governor's proposed budget means relative to where we were back prior to Measure 5, which really was the catalyst for what we're facing in school funding in Oregon today. The following series of slides uses the quality education model as a tool to evaluate what the level of funding proposed by the governor really means in terms of what the model would consider full funding of schools. And also it uses the model as a tool to evaluate the impacts on school districts of various levels of state school funding. Slide 25 here really is a sort of a general description of what the quality education model recommends in order to achieve what the commission had adopted as goals, the goal being getting 90% of students to meet standards. With full funding of the model, which would require a state school fund of just a hair under $7 billion in 0305, the model predicts that we would get 90% of elementary school students to standard by 2005, middle school students by 2008, and high school students by 2012. Clearly, at funding levels lower than what the model recommends, particularly at levels substantially below what the model recommends, which is what we're talking about now, these dates will be delayed. We really, in the estimation of the commission, we can't ask districts to get their students to standard on these dates if we're not going to provide sufficient levels of funding in order to do that. Slide 26 takes a look at what the implications of the governor's proposed budget are. First, what it does is lay out the assumptions that the governor makes in arriving at his number of $5.05 billion. The starting point for the governor's budget was a roll-up of where we currently are in the 0103 biennium. That number is approximately $5.6 billion if we simply start where we are today and roll it up to 0305. The governor made a number of assumptions in developing his $5.05 billion budget. And they're laid out here. No cost of living or step increases for teachers, no salary increases for for administrative staff or for classified staff, no increases in the expenses of districts to purchase health insurance for their employees, and no inflation in the purchase of supplies and other services that districts purchase. And you can see the breakout here. The model can estimate the savings from each of those assumptions if the assumption actually comes true. The biggest one is salary and step increases for teachers. That saves, if in fact districts are able to achieve that, saves $257 million over the 03-05 biennium, and you can see the other amounts here. The total savings of the assumptions made by the governor are $559 million. He then assumes that we can add back $100 million to help prevent the reduction in the number of school days, and for a net savings of $459 million. That's how the governor arrived at his budget of 5.05. Slide 27 takes a slightly different view of it. It asks the question, if the governor's assumptions are not accurate, if those savings can't be made, and clearly some of them probably can't be made. Some districts will be able to hold their salaries down through negotiations with their teachers. Some won't. Obviously, we have no control over the prices of supplies and services. Districts don't have control over those. So the assumption of no inflation in those is I think, one that is likely not to come true. The ability of districts to pass on, in a sense, their health care costs to their employees or to achieve lower premiums from their insurers is clearly one that there are some questions about whether that assumption is achievable. What we do in slide 27 is assume that none of those assumptions can be achieved, and what sort of cuts need to be made at the school district level in order to get down to the governor's $5.05 billion budget.
And then we would assume that on slide 28, the savings would be able, or the assumptions would be realized that the governor built into his budget, and we'd be looking at those impacts.
Correct.
The one thing the committee might be interested in that Mr. Reeder shared with me is a stack spreadsheet that is kind of the top level of information on the quality education model that's available to people. And you can actually manipulate and write your own assumptions and scenarios using the spreadsheet. So for people that are facile in how to work that kind of a system, it's not very complex in the way that it's set up, but it is very illuminating in the impacts that it has when you start moving one of the numbers around, the impacts that it has on other areas. And that is available to everyone to have that tool.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mesrin.
Just for clarification, when I look at the $5.05 billion and the reduction of 15% in the central administration and services and the school-level administrators, and then I go to the next category, 4.66, is that taking an additional 10%, or is that, are we starting with a whole new ballgame here?
Different scenario, Senator. The scenario on page 27 makes the assumption that none of the governor's assumptions will come true.
Okay.
And the scenario on page 28 makes the assumption that all of them will come true. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Madam Chair,
Senator Meserly, I think your question is an appropriate one. If we were to go to slide 28 and right now, slide 28 assumes that all the savings the governor has assumed can be realized, and then these other cuts would be on top of those savings.
Correct.
If, in fact, we made an alternative scenario that said the savings the governor has assumed can't be realized, then you're correct. We would add the impacts of slide 27 and slide 28, because then both of those would be necessary.
And slide 29, Madam Chair. You went to the third scenario.
Slide 29 is only a slight variation on slide 28. The difference is the target budget amount, rather than being $4.66 billion, it's $4.64, $200 million less. The only difference between 28 and 29 is that 29 would require, as it's laid out in this scenario, one additional teacher to be reduced in each high school in the state, which saves the additional $200 million.
Clarification, Ms. McGlash.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm sure this is what Mr. Reeder intended, but the difference between the two slides is about $20 million. He said $200 million, and I'm sure you've figured out it's not.
What's a zero among friends?
But it does, it does show you that just with a slight increase, or excuse me, decrease of about $20 million, relative impact in the number of teachers that would have to be reduced for the increase in class size.
I hesitate to get into a huge discussion on these scenarios because they are scenarios, but I think that the value of them is that it shows you the impact of what we're talking about and that it is going to be a very real impact. I would very strongly urge the members of this committee to become familiar with that spreadsheet and the very powerful tool that it is in trying to analyze the impact that taking money out of the system is going to have. And with that, what I would like to do now is to move on to Mr. Warner and a discussion of the the task force that met over the interim and the report that came out of that task force. I do want to thank very much the Department of Education for the report that you gave us, and also I want to thank you very much for the cooperation. And I think that this has been very satisfying from the point of view of our accessibility to your information and your willingness to open the doors over there and let us come in and try to kind of get our arms around what's going on. And I just want to make it very clear that I really appreciate the professional level that we've worked together with.
We share that and thank the chair for her comments and look forward to continuing that relationship. We have the same goal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Warner.
Madam Chair, I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer.
If I might just bring the committees on speed, this is what you're looking for, and it was in the packet of information that you got yesterday from LFO. And mine still has my flipping device on it.
Madam Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer, and the report before you, Revenue Options School Funding Accountability Task Force, was released January 22nd, and it's a result of Special Session 3, House Bill 4063, which created the framework, but actually, because of the subsequent special sessions, the task force was not formed until really October of 2002, and the work was done from October through January.
It was very intense.
Very intense, yes. The key charge really from House Bill 4063 was to evaluate and prepare options that would lessen Oregon's dependence on the personal income tax. I think everybody here recognizes that Oregon taxes, about 75% of our taxes at the state level come from the personal income tax, the highest percentage of any state on any single tax. The task force itself, if you look on page 1, shows you the membership and also spells out the task force and the secondary charge really beyond the finding ways to diversify the revenue system. There was a charge to look at some specific revenue sources, increase stability, look at the current property tax system. There was also a charge really to look at school finance and accountability alternatives for management of costs. And so we did spend a good deal of time in that area. The task force was assisted by an advisory council that was also established in the bill. And that was chaired by a former Governor Attia and consisted of superintendents from around the state and also business people in particular. We had a number of businessmen, including Jim Johnson, who testified before the full Ways and Means Committee a couple weeks ago. One of the things that I think was particularly important emphasized by the chair of the advisory council was previous work that had been done. And, of course, former Governor Attia was very intimately familiar with a 1985 tax reform effort that had been done prior to Measure 5. We did get that report and go through that with the committee. Also, the 1993 Measure 1. Both of those efforts were very detailed, had a number of elements in them, including spending limits, rainy day funds, a number of things that I think have kind of been forgotten over time. Finally, there was a good discussion of the 1998 review of the Oregon tax system, in particular the technical advisory group that was chaired by U.S. Bank Chief Economist John Mitchell, which really emphasized the instability of the revenue system and actually in many ways foresaw what was to happen here in over the last couple of years, particularly with the bubble in the stock market and the lost capital gains revenue. There was also a good deal of effort put into public testimony. There were meetings around the state. The bill directed the task force to meet in each of the five congressional districts. Every one of those meetings was well attended. We got testimony, and I would say at least 20 to 25 people testifying. And so we got a variety of perspectives and a number of suggestions. So I think that was turned out to be something very positive for the task force. Let me just talk about the key findings, and I'll just go through those key findings very briefly and also talk a little bit and address any questions you have in terms of the recommendations. You know, I think a number of these things are pretty clear to you and obvious, but they're really the idea here is to put them into a single document. Certainly the shift from property taxes to the income tax changed the entire revenue system, centralized it, made it more unstable, and school finances were very much in the forefront of that because they took the brunt of the Measure 5 reductions as it was school property taxes that were limited far more than local government property taxes. A couple of things, though, that were emphasized by both the advisory council and the task force is number three there, that the income tax collections we experienced in the 90s were something that were seen as an aberration. And the revenue from the capital gains above the long-term trend, we estimate, added about $670 million to the general fund last biennium. And those dollars are, for all intents and purposes, gone for the foreseeable future. We also recognize that these 9901 program level that was achieved at that time is essentially not sustainable with the current revenue system. So this requires either some changes at the expenditure level or in the revenue system. And that's, of course, exactly the issues that you're confronting now. The other things that they were pointed out, one of the things that the school superintendents emphasized was the success that had been achieved throughout the state, emphasizing that school achievement has improved. There had been significant progress toward the goals that you saw outlined a few minutes ago. SAT scores are higher. So there was a recognition and an emphasis on the part of the school community that a number of positive things have been happening over the last 10 years. We did receive a report that was commissioned by OSBA from Echo Northwest that went through the different comparisons on per-student spending among the states. We also received a similar report from Secretary of State Audits Division, which gave some good objective information, and I think the task force recognized that, that there are a number of different ways of looking and comparing school spending, and those were laid out, I think, very thoroughly for the task force. The other things in terms of costs there, 10 and 11 in particular, the growth in federal mandates, the ESL population, and number 11 in particular emerged as a key issue, the special education growth in spending on special education, and that that's far outpaced any federal assistance in that area. So it was one of the key drivers in school budgets. Finally, a recommendation that was really added by the task force near the end of their deliberations was the sense, and I think this came from the meetings with from the public input, was as accountability links between local school districts and their communities have been eroded by the shift to a more centralized revenue system. In the sense that there had been a disconnect there as a result of that centralized financing.
Mr. Warner, I think that this is an area that I know there has been a lot of discussion in over the interim and into this session, in that we have a really disconnected system in the way that it's funded and the way that it is accountable for the funding.
Yes.
I don't know if you covered point number 9 on your list here, which I think is also a critical issue as we go through our budget discussions here, and that is that 80% of the money that is spent in the schools is on salaries and benefits, and some of the highest or fastest rising costs in those areas are the cost of providing health care to the people that work in the system and the cost of the unfunded actuarial liability in the PERS system.
Yes. And, of course, the education, primary and secondary education, is very labor-intensive. I mean, that's where the costs of operations are. So anything that affects labor costs are going to have a disproportionate effect on the state school fund. After kind of laying out those findings, and the task force recommendations are there, and they're broken into two categories: those that deal with accountability and cost management, really more in terms of management or budgetary issues, and the second grouping is around the revenue options piece of the charge. So this was how it was.
And before you head off into these two separate directions here, let me just remind the committee that our charge is in the cost management and accountability arena, and that the revenue options discussion will take place other than in this room.
You're no fun, Madam Chair.
I will emphasize the first section, Madam Chair. getting really at the point that the Chair raised on labor costs is the first recommendation, and that is no surprise, I think, but the impact of rising PERS costs, of course we know that in the K through 12 system, PERS costs are actually higher than in the state general fund, and those rising PERS costs are a key to maintaining some control over labor costs, and so that was emphasized from the beginning. The committee didn't spend a lot of time, either the advisory committee or the task force, a lot of time talking about that issue, but they recognizing that other groups are working on that, but they wanted to bring that out to the forefront and say this is one of the number one factors in cost management. The second recommendation is to that there should be a link between the standards and assessment system and compare those with what has been passed at the federal level, the No Child Left Behind. There were a number of presentations in that area. And make sure those two are synchronized to the degree possible. And if the state has goals that are statutorily laid out, that there's not consensus or agreement on among the legislature, then those should be modified. So either reaffirmed or modified on the state goals. And this came up again and again, this emphasis on what are the goals of the education system? Is there agreement on what those goals? And this was a necessary first step before you get to cost management or revenue options, either one.
Madam Chair. Senator Gordley.
Thank you. This is where I would remind us that the quality education model focuses on a goal of 90% high achievement for all students. And in saying that, I think that's a flawed public policy model. We should be talking about 100% as a goal, because we know that historically, we know who that 10% of students will be who get left behind. So until we address that piece, continuing to focus on the QEM or the quality education model as our goal without adjusting the goal is problematic from where I sit.
Mr. Warner.
Okay. The third recommendation here is a recommendation of a greater effort to inform the public. There has been, you know, this gets back to the disconnect issue in terms of local communities and the school districts. There was a good deal of discussion at that time. In November, of course, we had elections talking about local options, about school bond measures that were on at that time, and how much connection and understanding that the public had on what education's goals were, and also back to some of the achievements that the schools have in terms of obtaining those goals. So, again, that was a recommendation to increase that dialogue, to make the public more aware of what the goals are and how the schools are doing in achieving those goals.
Mr. Warner, in the course of the discussions in that area, were there any suggestions put forward for realistic ways to accomplish that?
In terms of number three and ways of getting the more public buy-in, more public understanding?
Yes.
There was considerable discussion of that. But I think there was also a recognition that the publics in many cases, when you're looking at a local school district, vary so much. You know, you have 198 districts, you have small districts in which the schools are very much prominent in the life of the community. I mean, it's something that everybody's aware of, and there is, it's a different kind of approach and dialogue that goes on there than you would have, for example, in a large urban district, where there has to be much more efforts in terms of reaching out to the public and getting better understanding. So there was a discussion of those obstacles, but there was not any kind of statewide kind of solution to do that.
This is one of the areas where I think that we're going to have a great deal of difficulty in communicating to the people of Oregon why we're doing what we're doing in this building in this legislative session. And I think it's going to be, at best, very confusing to try to bring the people that pay taxes and that vote on issues in this state to a place where they understand what we're trying to undertake here and trust that we're doing a reasonable job with what we're doing. And I recognize that there is a kind of a built-in dissonance here between what happens in this building and how it's viewed on the local district level. And what I would submit to people that are listening and following these issues is that we can collectively shoot each other in the foot on this, or we can work together to try to make people understand much better what the challenges are that we face and what the possible range of solutions are, and try to engage the people in Oregon in that discussion.
Yes, Madam Chair, and you know, getting back to an earlier finding that actually complicates things, I think, for you and for the public and understanding is that you can use some of the measures we have and really show some different kinds of results depending on what measure you have, whether, you know, school spending has grown relative inflation or whether it hasn't. Some of that depends on the kinds of measures that you use, and one of the things that was talked about at the task force level is try to find some objective measures that there can be some consensus around to use, recognizing that some of these other measures are correct in a technical sense, but they're not really revealing in terms of what's overall what's happening. So that may be one element to that as well.
I agree, and I think a piece of the dialogue needs to be where education, where the spectrum of education fits into the spectrum of services that the state offers, yes, and where the K-12 system fits in within education and within that broader spectrum of services.
Yes, and Madam Chair, we did have on the Advisory Council some members from local government who emphasized that as well, particularly county government, that, you know, counties are involved in a large number of services beyond education. So these issues do interrelate with one another very much. The next set of recommendations there, number four in particular, I think is really directed probably more than anything else at this subcommittee and at Ways and Means Committee and the Department of Education. But and this really came from the superintendents, an emphasis that the ability to analyze data, the amount of data, has grown. And it is significant out there, and an emphasis that a number of the school budgets, Portland budget, Eugene budget, or Salem budget, or Beaverton, that if you looked at those in isolation, would be one of the largest state agencies that you have to deal with on an individual basis. So the emphasis was that there is data that's more available, and that there needs to be better ways for you as decision makers to kind of weigh those trade-offs as you're looking at decisions on how to balance the overall state school fund. So,
well, we did have a discussion very briefly in the committee yesterday about the data initiative, the block of data that's available there, and the fact that it is very detailed, and the strength of it is that it's the same over all of the districts. The weakness of it is that it's a shallow pool of data, and that as the years roll by and we get the depth of data there, it is going to be, I think, a very, very powerful management tool as we try to make policy decisions at this level.
This also, though, as we get into the data, this implies changing the formula and all that that is involved, and I assume that's not our charge normally, is it?
I think the formula is an issue that covers the revenue side, the policy side, and the fiscal side, and that when we get into those kinds of discussions, that it's a policy issue that this whole building needs to be involved in.
Madam Chair, we do have some bills. In fact, one that has passed out of the Senate Revenue Committee that will make some minor changes to the formula. So those are bills to possibilities. But I'd also refer you to point 8 there on the School Accountability Cost Management Recommendations, which gets at your issue, Representative March, where the data side of this, as that grows, that's improved. The foundation of the formula, school distribution formula, was really established in 91, and I think anyone that was intimately involved with that would recognize there was some areas where there was a fair amount of information at the time and some areas where there wasn't. So as information grows, the recommendation here is to review those factors to make sure they're truly reflecting cost, because that's what the formula, what the distribution formula is designed to do, is to objectively measure cost differentials among the districts.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Did the task force talk at all about extending the way that we look at funding from to include pre-K through 12? As opposed to just starting with K through 12?
Senator Gordon, there was some discussion of that and the link and importance of that area. I wouldn't say that level of discussion was put into a point of having recommendations regarding it. So, I mean, the focus really was on the K-12 component, and, you know, that was the emphasis of the work.
It seems, Madam Chair, that a more holistic approach would have us looking at by starting with pre-K, especially when you consider that we have an Oregon benchmark that says we'll have all pre-K eligible children served by, was it 2004. We're not going to make it, but again, mm-hmm. it just seems to be a disconnect between the benchmark and where we start our overall funding discussion.
Well, one thing I will add, Senator Gordley, on that area, there was an emphasis on expectations of schools back to the goals, but also the expectations of what schools are to accomplish, and a recognition that society really expects a different product from schools than it did 10 years ago. And that was emphasized by the superintendents. And I think that clearly the pre-K element is a key component of that, because as kids come into school, many of the issues are already been determined, that whether the schools are going to have to bear some additional costs or not.
The ready-to-learn issues, exactly. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, and I think the point you make is a piece of the discussion, or maybe an extension of the discussion, that's raised in the fifth recommendation, that we really have a kind of pre-Measure 50 timing cycle, and it doesn't mesh very well with what we do in this building.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Madam Chair, there was certainly discussion of about number five, about the timing, the annual budget process that the districts go through. That's a lengthy process beginning in the spring, and they work through that. Of course, now as they begin working on their budgets, they don't really have, they're just speculating what the state school fund will be. So it is a major source of uncertainty. We did have the luxury in the post-Measure 5 world that for the first 4 or 5 biennia, we had more property tax revenue than anticipated. And, of course, we also had more general fund revenue. So there was some certainty there, surety, as we saw the dollars come in, that we knew there was more than had been budgeted. And that I think, really helped the districts. But, of course, when that reverses itself, and even though local revenue, I mean, that has held up reasonably well. We've had some shortages there. That actually began the prior biennium in 1909, as you recall. But to be forced to adjust their budgets now in the middle of the school year is extremely difficult for the districts.
Well, and I think that the process that we took all of the areas that state revenue funds through during the 5 special sessions and even into the 6th special session was not a place that any of us would choose to go again. And I think that we recognize that from the point of view of trying to provide a continuity of service and make sound policy decisions and keep systems functioning, that you probably couldn't figure out a worse way to do it than what we ended up doing. But hindsight is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And when you're actually in the trench there and trying to figure out what the next battle is going to look like, you have a very different perspective on things. But I do agree that one of the huge problems that we have here is that the time cycle that the state is on is very disparate and not at all synchronized with the timing cycle that the school districts are on.
Yes. The sixth recommendation there was in terms of reviewing state mandates. I don't think there was a real consensus at all that there are certain mandates that should be eliminated, but a recognition that mandates should be reviewed and examined on a regular basis, so that to make sure they are consistent with the goals mentioned above, and that there's not mandates that are there that increase costs without moving the districts toward achieving those goals. So again, that was an emphasis in terms of there was not an emphasis on eliminating mandates that were related to the goals, but to eliminate those that were extraneous. And the seventh point there, I think, is related really to the amount of data that's available for the to analyze school budgets, and that is a recognition that we're getting to the point now where districts are collecting detailed student data at the individual level, and there should be an effort from the Department of Education and working with the school districts to try to set up a statewide database so that this could help to improve an understanding give input in terms of what are some of the reasons why we may not be achieving goals and what are the kinds of things that could follow from that data that would recommend changes in policy.
Recognizing that the revenue options discussion won't take place in this committee, but I think that these findings are interesting and do help somewhat frame the discussions that we will have on the cost management side.
Okay. So I'll go through these quickly, Madam Chair. And you know, as just before I start, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, the task force and also the advisory group, even though they had a lot of experience and understanding of the issues, you know, there's really not a consensus of saying, yeah, we ought to do this to raise revenue instead of that. There was more of a discussion of principles. A number of people had some very specific suggestions, but there was not unanimity or consensus on that. But one of the things I'll point out is that after this section on the recommendations, there is a list of other recommendations, other options. And these are things that were recommended by primarily the advisory committee and things you may want to look at some later time, and which enjoyed some support. Some of them enjoyed significant support among the advisory committee, but didn't reach a consensus level. In terms of the revenue options, I think there is a clear understanding that the federal government is an important factor, especially in the area of special ed, and a cry and to our congressional delegation to try to help get more federal assistance in that area. And we've seen some of that, but I think there's a recognition that a lot more would be helpful now. It's hard to say what position the federal government will be as it has gone, as deficits are growing now over the last couple of years. But certainly there's a recognition that that could be an important factor. The second point there, to clearly define the need, I think it's back and matches some of the earlier discussion about there needs to be an understanding among the public of what the product is, what education is providing, how important it is, what are the kinds of things that are being done. And that becomes critical in a state like Oregon where the initiative process is very important. And, of course, any kind of major revenue proposal that were to come from the legislative body, there's a high chance of referendum as well. So the emphasis was the public needs to have a clear acceptance of the need, and that becomes a necessary pre-step before seriously pursuing any type of major revenue changes. The third point was to emphasize the economic feedback effects of any change in the revenue system. There was a good deal of discussion about transition costs. And one of the facts of life is, and one of the things that makes tax reform so difficult, is we could all sit around and agree that the current tax system is not optimal. There's a number of ways it could be improved, could be better. But the point is you have decision makers, whether individuals or businesses, who have made decisions based on that old system. And when you change that system, then you change their calculations. You change their net rates of return. What was a smart investment under a no sales tax system doesn't look so smart when you have a sales tax. And the same could be said of Washington. If you make an investment under a no income tax system, doesn't look so good if Washington were to change that system. So that's a recognition that becomes an obstacle to be overcome on any kind of major change in the revenue system, is to recognize that investments have been made under the old system.
Well, and I think another aspect to this, too, is that the whole revenue piece is very intertwined and very complex, and that there are a lot of unintended consequences to things that are put on the table, and it is very complicated to try to work through to the edges of the system what those unintended consequences are. I have in my mind this kind of visual of a plate of spaghetti, and if you pull a noodle out, things happen that you didn't anticipate, and that kind of is my impression of the revenue picture and the tax laws.
Yes. And one of the factors that becomes critical in that is federal policy and how federal policy is related to that. And that's been a particular obstacle of a traditional retail sales tax is the fact that the federal government does not allow deductibility of that sales tax, whereas it does a property tax, a personal income tax at the state level. So the feds have, in effect, changed the costs and benefits of certain revenues by their policies on deductibility. There was also an emphasis on administration and how important it is that even if whatever revenue source we're looking at looks good at the theoretical level, that the compliance and administrative costs are accounted for and can be done in an efficient manner. There was a good deal of lively discussion about the distribution of the tax burden and the current distribution. We use a tool we developed a couple of years ago called OTIM, which is the Oregon Tax Incidence Model, which allows us to trace through economic effects of tax changes and the ultimate burden of a tax. And what that shows is that Oregon's distribution of its current tax system has a regressive tail in which there's a higher tax rate at the low end for low-income people, primarily because of the property tax. After that, it's essentially proportional. So I think that, well, clearly from the discussion, the direction on this recommendation is to, if you're going to go through a major revenue changes, don't do something that dramatically changes the current distribution of the tax burden, that the roughly proportional system enjoys a fair amount of general acceptance, and if you're going to take on a major change in the revenue system, that should be one of the goals, to maintain that proportionality. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be efforts to deal with particular elements, such as the higher tax rate at the low end, and that was discussed at length. There was also a recognition that broad-based public services like K-12, like the things that really make up your general fund, should be funded with broad-based taxes, and those broad-based taxes are income, property, or wealth, and consumption. There was also a good deal of discussion about the personal income tax base and broadening it through reducing tax expenditures, reducing the elements that lower collections for a given tax rate. However, the particularly advisory committee recognized that doing that has kind of the reverse effect of what the charge of the task force was, and that was to reduce dependence on the income tax. If you end up raising more money from the income tax, whether it be through higher rates or through reducing tax expenditures, the net effect is the same. You increase dependence. So that was a concern and recognition. And finally, number seven there on the revenue options gets at the issue of the school funding local options and a recommendation that those should be examined. We did have a local option that passed in 1999, and the task force was very aware of some of the practical problems that have arisen from trying to implement that local option. Final two things I'll mention, Madam Chair, is that on pages 12 to 15, you can see an evaluation of the major approaches to revenue, whether it expand the income base, go to a consumption base, and just a listing of advantages and disadvantages. That's something you may want to look at some point. And finally, what at least to me was very interesting was we had asked for a presentation from NCSL. Steve Smith came out from Denver and talked at one of the public meetings in Portland. And his presentation is on page 18, but it kind of went through what other states, what's been happening in other states. And of course, sometimes we we forget that we are not alone, and states have been wrestling with this education funding. And of course, many states have had much messier equalization processes among districts than we've gone through. But also a discussion about some of the different approaches to how do you achieve equity, and how do you balance equity with adequacy. And how do you make this transition on a revenue side away from the property tax? Because property tax is not only unpopular in Oregon, but it's pretty much unpopular amongst all the states. And many states have been wrestling with ways to try and to find alternative revenue to the property tax.
Well, and there is an issue around the stability of revenue sources, too, the need for the education system to have a reliable and predictable source of revenue that you can plan on. And I think that we raised our eyes several times over the interim as we watched the capital gains revenue crash, mm-hmm. and the corporate tax receipts crash, mm-hmm. and thought a lot about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and on the other side of that, we've learned some of the more stable revenue sources. Property taxes have been far more stable, certainly under Measure 50. And, of course, the other one has been lottery revenue. Has been very stable.
That's Senator Messerly.
If I might voice a concern I have, going back to the recommendations on school accountability and cost management, as I look at bullet point 5 and 8, I have a real concern. In relation to number 5, I understand the difficulty of school year adjustments. But really, I see no other option to that except to budget more conservatively and build a sizable reserve fund. Mm-hmm. Just the way the politics and the way our sessions work, and especially when you get into a deficit situation like we've had this last year. So it seems very clear to me that the only way we can reach that goal is to just be much more conservative as we budget for education. And that relationship with going down to number 8, and from my experience at having served on a school board for several years, and the lack of reserves in a lot of the school districts across the state. A few of them, I believe, still have some reserves, although they've been really, really eating into those reserves tremendously. And we're seeing a situation where we're in crisis management, not only in other agencies, but in our local school districts and local governments in general. And in my opinion, it's, to some degree at least, is brought on by a mentality of continually betting on hopefully better revenues, even though many times we really can't substantiate that very well at all. And I felt this way strongly when I served on my local school board, that someday we're going to get caught short and really, really be in a very, very difficult situation. And I guess what I'm really saying is that I think it's too often, and I don't know the answer to this, but local governments and school districts budget and negotiate with their personnel based on funds they don't have. And so, again, I don't know the answer to that. I'd be interested in if the task force had thought that through at all, or if it was discussed. But I don't know if there's a legislative way to fix it, or you know, it's a very complex, difficult situation. But it, to me, it's a blueprint for disaster.
Senator, the task force did talk about that a good deal. About, of course, there was discussion about stabilization funds. The Education Stability Fund had been created just prior to this, and pretty much universal recommendation for that kind of an approach to have some reserve funds available. But I think also there was clear recognition that the state school fund has become such a large portion of the general fund, it becomes very difficult to say that this will be protected in some way, unless, again, as you point out, unless you have a very large ending balance. that would give you the flexibility to deal with other aspects of the budget. So I think there was a recognition, but not a consensus recommendation on how to deal with that. The other thing I might say, too, is that on local property taxes, we talk about stability, but as you recall, in 1901, we had a 1% reduction in the forecast, and that was $20 million for the biennium. So that's a big factor, too, and potentially could be something out there in the future that if we have a property tax shortfall, that you end up, even if the general fund is holding close to forecast, you end up having to deal with in the interim.
The colleagues, we are past the time where we're supposed to vacate this room, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5016. I have two housekeeping announcements before you make for the door. First of all, tomorrow our hearing will begin at 8:30 till 10:30, the regular time, but we'll be in 174. This room will be used for a different purpose. There was wrong information in the press about the public input aspect of this budget hearing. The public testimony will be taken Wednesday night from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock in this room, and also Thursday morning from 8:30 to 10:30, also in this room. There will be no public input taken. There will be no meeting on Thursday night. And having no further business before the committee, we're adjourned. We'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow.